Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to have this session. It's and people getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning, that's impressive. So I'm going to do more of a historical perspective, you know, because I feel like we keep reinventing the wheel, and I see a lot of papers published that the basics aren't being understood, or some of the previous research isn't really looked at, and some of it may be not, you may not pick it up when you use your normal search engine. Anyway, I think we've seen this before, what we're talking about in terms of assays, enzyme assays, but just historically, actually, the first evidence that there's enzyme activity was in 1899, actually in Columbus, Ohio, and I think there was a quote in 1901, which is pretty much says it all, and in some ways we haven't really learned much more than this today. Metabolism of bacteria or yeast, or by enzymes secreted by these organisms, or by higher plants, are of vital importance in agricultural processes. Without their agency in breaking up organic compounds, the soil would rapidly become unfit for supporting life. So we had a little bit of perspective on the enzyme assays, and that was using the para-nitrophenol approach. But really, even before that, using natural substrates and products, there was much earlier work that was done, and you can see some of the examples here through time. Actually, starting at the turn of the 20th century, they were already doing proteases and amidases, peroxidase were all being used, with potentially a number of problems, which is why, of course, the para-nitrophenol came along later. And then much later we got the fluorogenic approach when that came along. So here's one of the things that as people interpret enzyme data is, well, we think of enzymes as some living cell, or it's produced by a living organism, therefore it automatically equates with something should be correlated or highly related to the microbial community. But an enzyme can be free, it can be completely separate from the source. And this is very true in soil. And this wasn't really, people kind of saw it, but it wasn't until the 1950s that this was really conclusively determined. And Douglas McLaren at Berkeley, at University of California, was the guy that kind of really put the nail in the coffin on that. But essentially, what I'll show some data shortly is that what he did is showed that you can sterilize the soil and still have enzyme activity. So what that's suggesting is there has to be enzymes that are outside the cells, no longer controlled by the cells, and in some cases that can be a lot of activity. So Douglas McLaren was an organic chemist, got interested in this, and did a lot of different things over the years. In fact, he even used enzyme activities in forensic work. He thought there were some approaches that could be used in solving crimes. So a very interesting guy. But in many ways, he had a big impact, because a lot of the people that came after that were in his lab, and one of whom was Tabatabai, which was our major professor, and Richard Burns, you probably know from SBB, and John Skujens, who's at Utah State, was also in that lab. And they all got interested in enzymes because of this guy, Douglas McLaren. So what he did is he irradiated soils with X-rays and gamma radiation, and he also just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation. If you take how much enzyme activity you have and do a back-of-the-envelope calculation and compare that to how much is in a gram of fungi, or you get the equivalent, really, of some of these enzymes of the amount of biomass you need of 1 gram of fungal biomass, or 10 billion bacterial cells. So that's way higher than anything that's really possible in soil. So if you just do that calculation, you have to say that there's a lot more, there's enzymes here that really are not part of a living organism anymore. So if you sterilize soil, this is just oxygen consumption, and you look at this line here, this is McLaren's work, it's just flat, which says when you irradiate the soil, it's basically dead. There's no reproduction. It cannot consume oxygen. So there's no metabolic processes occurring. But yet, in the same soil, the irradiated soil it's continuing, it actually has very high activity. So if you hit it just right and you kill everything and stop any regrowth basically lights all the cells, and don't hit it too hard. If you hit it too hard, it will degrade those enzymes. But if you hit it at the right level, the enzyme activity continues. So the point is that when you measure enzyme assays, you don't know how much is happening because of this portion that's no longer affiliated with a living cell compared to what might be closely related. So the theory was that as the microbial community excretes enzymes, and by and large, many of the enzymes that we are interested in, hydrolytic enzymes involved in carbon cycling, phosphorus, and so forth, those are excreted out into soil solution because the substrates they're working on are too large or too insoluble to be taken up by the cell. So they put out the enzyme. So as soon as they put out the enzyme, they basically lose control of it in a way. Now, so some of those enzymes are going to be in soil solution, but through McLaren's work, it became pretty obvious, and actually one other point here is that he had the same soil that was, when it was irradiated, had very high activity, but when it was stripped of its organic matter, it basically went to zero. So what that was saying is that there's a large amount that probably is associated with enzymes stabilized on clay surfaces and with organic colloids with various types of interactions. So this is just a schematic, very old, from a paper just showing the enzyme being stabilized on a clay surface. And obviously when this happens, of course, it's going to change the conformation or the reaction rates, the kinetics are going to change some, but the enzyme can still be catalytic and still be functional. So this led then to the question, well, what does this really mean? And so Richard Burns kind of came up with this theory of what this might mean, or at least putting in terms of the location of where enzymes could be. And John Skoogeons coined this term abiontic, and that is the correct spelling. It's a Greek word meaning something of biological origin, but no longer associated with its source, is in essence what abiontic means. So that could be that could be enzymes that are in solution, and these probably are. If you could correlate this isolate this activity with microbial measures, you might get some correlation. But oftentimes you don't get correlation because there's a lot of enzymes that are, depending on which one you're working with, are stabilized in the soil matrix. So you have cell debris, you have other enzymes that are absorbed on clays, or they're complex in humic substances, and these can be there for decades. In fact, they carbon dated some of these up in Alaska, and there are enzymes that are thousands of years old that are still functional, still catalytic. So they can be there a long time if they're protected. So then the question is, well, what does that really mean? This is still an open question. What is the microbial ecology of having stabilized enzymes? So we've already talked about this. They put out these extracellular enzymes because of the substrates they're working on are insoluble or too large to be taken up. But the question is there any ecological advantage? And potentially you can imagine that there are microorganisms that have evolved to basically live in the debris or with other stabilized enzymes, because then they don't have to expend the energy to produce those enzymes. They can take advantage of a stabilized enzyme. So that was a theory that Richard Burns put forward in the late 70s and early 80s, which still really hasn't been proven, I would say. So there's a research project for somebody, if you can figure out ways to do that. So there likely are, and you can find many organisms that live in soils. They don't have phosphatase activity. They don't have many of these enzymes. And they probably take either advantage of other organisms that produce them, but they also might take advantage of these stabilized enzymes that are already in the soil matrix. So this is just a nice schematic of showing where all the enzymes can be. Certainly there can be some on soil on surfaces. And of course there are enzymes that do occur inside the cell, but they tend to be redox type of assays, not the ones that often are working on decomposition or hydrolytic or mineralization type of enzymes, and those are the ones that tend to be extracellular. So you can have a living organism, they can die, there can be enzymes associated there. Then these can be trapped or stabilized on clays or entrapped in organic matter, but still remain catalytic. So the point is, when you run, put your assay, put your substrates in here, all of these things could be sources of where your activity is coming from, and you have no idea. It's just a sort of a black box. So just looking then at a couple other things in terms of the looking at the literature and the history and things that I think people ignore at times is that because of all that, enzyme activity does not necessarily equal microbial activity. And there was a good paper by Frankenberger and Warren Dick, not myself, and we're not related, by the way. If you ever see Warren Dick, we worked on phosphatase, we were both with Tabata Bio, but anyway, another story. They did a nice study, looked at 20 soils, and basically the only way they could really get consistent correlation with the number of enzymes they looked at is when you added glucose to the soil. So you add something that gives a quick carbon source, and yes, then you would get correlation of that of activity measurements, enzyme activity with microbial type of measurements. But oftentimes you don't, and the probably one of the main reasons is because a large amount of activity, and McLaren showed in a lot of the assays that he worked on, there was up to 40 to 60% of the activity is coming from this abiontic fraction, not from the microbial fraction. So another problem is that it could be that the enzymes being produced, even if there isn't any background happening with stabilized enzyme, it could be just a subpopulation that really produces that enzyme. And so if you're measuring the overall activity of the community, you're not capturing that small subpopulation that is actually the one producing those enzymes. The last kind of point I want to talk a little bit about is, and Xiaoping alluded to this, is you'll see a lot of papers where they try to mimic in situ conditions. And that could be pH. Well, the two primary ones are pH and temperature. So the problem there is that now you do not have an optimized system. You're not optimizing the method, talking about the race car analogy here. So I'm going to show a little data to go into that here. But if you do in situ, you can't optimize. So basically what you're doing with the enzyme assay is you're getting an index of how much of that protein or that enzyme is in the soil. And as soon as you optimize it, or do not optimize it, you're going to have a potential problem in that you really don't know where you're at. So another issue is you can't. Enzyme rate is not the same as a field-based rate of reaction. Those are two separate things. So people are trying to use enzyme assays to get a rate of reaction in the carbon cycle, in the nitrogen cycle, and then maybe plugging that into a model, you know, getting an algorithm out of that that then tells you, would help inform you on a model with using enzyme assay. And you really can't do that because when we do, even if you adjust the pH to the soil pH or you use a soil temperature of 15 degrees or 10 degrees or whatever, you're still a very artificial situation. You've saturated the substrate or the enzyme with substrate. You have cofactors. There's many other things that you do that are not in situ conditions. So even if you go back to the pH, you're still doing things that are not the same as the field. To do in the field, you have to go at what's the substrate actually out in the field. You need to measure it in the field. And, you know, maybe there are methods coming online with all of our microsensors. We may be able to do that. But right now, that's not possible. As soon as you take it back to the lab, you know, you're really changing the conditions that are not at all similar to what's under field conditions. So if you just look at the example of pH. So this is a paper that something that Tabata Bio in every method that his lab developed, they always have a curve, and this is Xiaoping's work after she left his lab. But this is just a classic soil pH curve you'll get when you do a pH curve on different soils. And typically, there is some optimum pH across all soils where you get the optimum pH. So let's just say, for example, here that we decide to go with the pH of the soil, and I just arbitrarily pick one soil. Let's say it has a pH of 7. So instead of optimizing, you just put water in, you don't buffer, or you adjust the pH of your incubation exactly to 7, and then you have another soil that happens to have a pH of 4.5. So if we run it at optimal conditions, we get a wide difference between them, because the race car, it's going, they're both going as fast as they can. But as soon as you get off of that optimum, now it starts to go down. So if we had two, we were comparing two soils here, and we just let them go to their pH, their natural soil pH. Now there's virtually no difference. So there's the problem you run into when you don't optimize. And there's a lot of papers out there that unfortunately are doing this. So if you do this, I mean, there can be reasons why you want to study that. That's fine. But if you're really interested in treatment effects, then you start to have problems, because you may mask treatment effects, or you might even change the order of treatment effects if you compare optimized to non-optimized. So if a person, I get papers like this, and it's always difficult what to do with them, and some of them I've rejected, but what I tell people is, look, if you're going to do this in situ approach, you should really also do the optimized. I mean, it is possible they could come out the same. I'm not saying that that could happen quite often, perhaps, but you never know. So I think the key is you have to remember you're only measuring the enzyme in an enzyme. It's a basic biochemistry. It's not microbial necessarily, and to really understand and to do that and to make an appropriate interpretation, you need to run under optimal conditions. That's kind of the main point of my talk. I think these are just some other things that, in thinking the broader perspective of how we can use enzyme activities in terms of research, there's some interesting things going on with biofilms, and of course with decomposition, a lot of ways we can use it. There's interesting things coming out in signaling, and we still have this issue of what does it really mean to have stabilized enzymes. What's the microbial ecology going on? I think would be a fascinating thing, and potentially with proteomics and some of the other omics out there, maybe there's a way now that we could actually do studies to figure out whether microorganisms can take advantage of those stabilized enzymes. And then also going with this also is linking gene expression with enzyme activity is another approach that we need to pursue more. So I think there's a lot of other research opportunities, and I think I'll just conclude with, go to my conclusion slide, which my main point, so for many enzymes, again, it's a combination of both stabilized enzymes and microbial, and so we really can't, you've got to be very careful how you interpret the data when you run these assays, and think about that, because it's important, like, to think about what was the treatment, the history of went on before. If it's something very recent change, short term, well, then maybe you could attribute more of that to microbial. But if you have a treatment that's been in place 5, 10, 20 years, you really have to think about, is it really my abiotic fraction that's increasing? And the other problem is you don't always know. Each enzyme assay, there's very few that have really been documented how much activity is coming from those. But but when you interpret, you have to interpret it very carefully, because it could be this going on, and which may not be necessarily closer to the microbial activity or the biomass or the composition of the community. So it's not often correlated with microbial properties. And lastly, again, I would just argue for getting away from non-optimized approaches. If you try to mimic in situ conditions, we should really still do an optimized set of optimized set of data as well. So with that, I'll conclude. Just a couple of other things here. One is, if you're not aware of it, we have SSSA has a book, a methods book that I was the editor on, and many of the people who put methods together wrote chapters. So it's a fairly comprehensive book on vetted methods, and there is one chapter on the microplate method as well. And I just acknowledge Tabatabai, who was our major professor and really was one of the people that really had a major impact on soil enzymology and many careers. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll probably take questions later, I guess.
Yes.
I was wondering if you have some data on, you know, what percent of things are in these romantic states versus, you know, I know it varies across different diseases, but I don't know if you have some.
Well, we did it in my lab. For beta-glucosidase, we have numbers, and it's roughly about on the order of 70-80%, and it varies with soil. Is abiotic. And McLaren, I don't know the numbers offhand, but I'm pretty sure McLaren did urease and phosphatase and maybe a couple of others. But the truth is, it hasn't been done on all the assays. So for many assays, it's certainly there, but we really don't know because you have to do some sort of sterilization process. We used a microwave, which works reasonably well. But irradiation is probably the best, but then you got to be set up to do that. So people aren't normally set up to do that, and so we it's not done like it should have been fully across all the assays.
It's probably also varied with the enzyme. Depending on the enzyme,
some
enzyme present enzyme or extracellular enzyme
right.
are more stable, and some of them
right.
they're inner cell and they're less stable.
Like protease, probably there's no stabilization. And if you air dry a soil and you do protease, it'll go to zero. So that would tell you, like protease, there's no stabilization in the fraction. But that's one of the few that I know of. But I should qualify that to say that there are enzymes that are truly, that do not, you know, become a part of the matrix. And dehydrogenase is the best example because that only occurs inside a viable cell. So when the cell dies, that enzyme is degraded. It has to or can't function outside the cell. So there are, I should say, there are enzymes that you can use that are, you know, specific and will reflect microbial activity, but not very many. And certainly all of those that we use in decomposition, hydrolytic mineralization studies, they are extracellular, and they're not. They're going to probably be stabilized in the matrix.
Yeah. Well, using the same enzyme, and we're measuring a big, you know, mixture soup in the soil. And for example, acid phosphatase, I'm familiar with. One of the bacteria I work with, there are two of them on the membrane, and two of them are inter.